Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everybody, welcome back to the show. This show is a part of our expanded coverage because of the Supercast subscribers. So obviously, you guys know what to do if you've not subscribed yet. If just 3% of our overall listenership, we're talking in the hundreds of thousands of people, support the show, we are covered for basically the next forever. So once again, general industry expectation is that 3 to 10% of actual listeners will subscribe. So if you are part of that 3 to 10%, we'd appreciate it so much. Link is in the top of the show. Once again, we're doing these extra episodes unpaywalled because we know that this extra content is really valuable. So I'll just throw a quick bit to you and then we'll get into the actual episode.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize, look, the stuff costs money. And I know it sounds boring and all of that. And people definitely overemphasize the costs, but it's real. I mean, you know, it costs hundreds of dollars in order to get this stuff done. Equipment costs, production costs, in terms of how we exactly run our YouTube channel, taxes. So anyway, look, I don't want to take too much of people's time, but it really does help it. If you like the content, this is the only way in order to make it possible. Marshall and I are huge believers in the subscription model, especially given the success of Breaking Points and others. And I think this really is the future and we should try and lean as much into the audience as possible without going to outside revenue sources.
For sure. Now to the actual content. Sagar, you suggested we hit this story at the very top of the episode. So obviously, Roe v. Wade, the leak of a probable decision by the conservative majority to overturn Roe v. Wade and send the question of abortion laws in America back to the states. You've talked about this a lot on Breaking Points. I think the listeners are aware of this. So I think a dynamic, which I think I'd love for you to start on, though, is this barstool conservative dynamic and Dave Portnoy's somewhat surprising, but frankly, not surprising comments if you really read into this. So A, explain barstool conservatism. Why does Dave Portnoy matter? And then get into like what actual take he had.
Yeah, for the gajillionth time. So I think barstool conservatism is the 2.0 version of the mid-2000s phenomenon, which was known as South Park conservatism, which was anti-political correctness, a lot more libertarian. But that in the mid-2000s was still directionally left-wing because it was allied against the Bush administration and against the moral majority and the Christian right. So obviously, the country has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. That was a huge theme of our last episode. The current barstool conservatism are people who I would describe as directionally right-wing, but not conservative. So a Joe Rogan who is anti-woke, anti-PC, pro-gun, I would say generally like embracing a masculinist type aesthetic. Let's go with that. Dave Portnoy, similarly, people are always kind of scrambles people's brains. We're stuck in the 90s. They're like, what are you talking about? Joe Rogan supports gay marriage. Joe Rogan supports abortion. Dave Portnoy has probably paid for multiple abortions. Dave Portnoy supports gay marriage. Dave Portnoy is very socially liberal, but he also endorsed Donald Trump in 2015. So how does that work? If you actually go back and you read Portnoy's original endorsement of Trump was he said, I don't care whatever else he says. He pisses everybody else off and doesn't care what people thinks. And I love that. Direct quote. That's exactly what he said in 2015. Now, look, Dave has tried to cover his tracks and be like, oh, I would support Biden if he ran, you know, again. And we'll see. Dave obviously played footsie with Trump throughout the entire presidency, interviewed Trump up in the lead into the 2020 election, and has been an outspoken person against the COVID regime. So what happened? That phenomenon basically is millions of people, mostly men, although it describes a lot of women too, who are anti-woke, anti-political correctness, but socially liberal in the 1990s version. And this is hard for people to get their heads around.
Can I add one thing to this, Sagar?
Yeah, go ahead.
Not, clearly not anti-vax. Was down for whatever was happening with COVID policy, probably in 2020 through 2021, but clearly, I'd say after summer 2021, started to push back
against whatever.
Anti-lockdown post summer 2021.
And that's basically me. Okay, this is why I fully identify kind of as like one of these people. Now, the thing is though, is that those people are anti-critical race theory. They're pro Florida bill for not teaching gender ideology to K through third graders, but they're pro gay marriage and they're pro-choice. And when I say pro-choice, they're not Lena Dunham, like, celebrate abortion. They're like safe, legal, and rare people. Okay. So basically like a Bill Clinton-esque 1990s Democrat whenever it comes to social policy. Okay. So what does that mean then? Well, those people are now really stuck in the lurch because the expanding GOP coalition were basically the Barstool conservatives. One third of the people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020 were pro-choice, explicitly pro-choice. Now, why did they vote for him? And these, by the way, are even more expanded in the celebrated Obama-Trump voter. They voted for Obama twice, after all. Why? Wasn't just economics, right? Obama didn't support gay marriage. Obama also wasn't, I mean, he was pro-choice and like he would say one thing to the liberal activists, but there's a reason that he didn't sign Roe versus Wade into law in 2009. Anyway, he was seen as socially moderate. I'm not saying he was seen that way in 2008. Well, all of this really plays against each other. The GOP was headed to a historic victory, probably R plus seven, R plus eight on the generic ballot, which translates to almost 50 seats in the House of Representatives. They were leading with parents over of children over 18 or under 18 by 60%, Marshall, based on the critical race theory and the gender ideology conversation. And then they were also up to 45, 50% amongst Latinos. The Latino conversation on pro-life issues is complicated, obviously, because of a disproportionate number of Catholics. So let's put that aside. The parents, especially, is where this one matters, especially with women. And then really, you know, I've talked about this before, kind of like the grill dad phenomenon. People don't realize this, but the only group of Americans where Trump dropped in support in the 2020 election was white men. And part of the reason for that is that if you were married, you were disproportionately more likely in order to switch your vote from Trump in 2016 to Biden. Married men in particular had the biggest, married white men had the biggest drop in the number of support for Trump. So obviously that carries over in terms of like women finding Trump particularly odious, but these people are not Democrats. And this is where the swing vote, the Youngkin voter, the kind of Barstool conservative grill dad type phenomena really matters whenever it comes to Roe versus Wade, because these people, they hate wokeness, hate political correctness, but they're pro-choice. And something that I've really observed is that I think that whoever seems most politically extreme on the culture on election day is the guy who loses. So obviously, it worked out for Biden in the end, but he came razor thin to almost losing the 2020 election. Obviously, Hillary didn't work out for her. Back in 2012, we can go to Todd Akin, you know, the legitimate rape conversation. These things have played out over time. Well, Republicans are now really put themselves in a spot. Here's the thing. 70% of the public does not want Roe versus Wade overturned. 70%. Okay. So the GOP response is, well, those people aren't going to care. We'll see. Because here's the thing, and this is why people don't think of it in Roe. This is not about Roe. We all know there's going to be some trigger-happy Alabamians who are banning abortion outright the moment that this thing becomes law in July. And so now, in the July period, in the lead-up to the election, you're now arguing about rape and incest and outright bans and whether like ectopic pregnancies are allowed in several southern states affecting, I don't know, maybe some 20, 30 million people. That's the national conversation on culture when it could have been about Florida. Well, guess what? 65% of the people support the Florida law. Critical race theory ban, overwhelmingly popular. You know, anti-COVID, obviously inflation. So look, I'm not saying the Republicans aren't going to win, Marshall, but they've shot themselves in the foot and possibly depleted the Barstool coalition. And I think this really culminated yesterday in Dave Portnoy on his show, The Dave Portnoy Show, where he came out and explicitly said, and I listened to the full podcast, the clip that's going on out there is actually not the full context. He said, taxes, you know, all this other stuff, whatever. He said, if this is an issue, I vote Democrat. Direct quote, I vote Democrat. And there's a reason for that, which is that Dave is socially really repulsed by the Christian right. And look, if there, I know there are evangelical people who are listening to this, but I actually thought that Matt Iglesias made a really good point, which is that the Bill Clinton safe, legal, and rare coalition of the 1990s, which was the majoritarian position, was actually the bros, the AKA like Barstool types, and the feminists. And it's right now, you're living in a world where like the feminists and the kind of the PMC left had been isolated in a, what I would say is a socially extreme agenda. And now you're actually splitting a huge portion of the new people who've been brought over to you over the last 2.5 years. That's a long way of putting that, but I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, no, couple immediate thoughts. So I did a good Breaking Points clip with Nate Hockman of National Review over the weekend. We were talking about this, and a lot of folks on the right thought that abortion decisions didn't matter because of the fact that last fall, obviously Texas passed a very aggressive, like really pushing the limits of the Roe v. Wade, they really pushed the limits of the fact
ban,
that
Roe v. Wade,
six week ban. Just pushed it as close as they could. And that didn't impact the November elections. Glenn Youngkin ended up winning. So a lot of folks said, see, it doesn't affect people who don't care. I have a couple of things I want to say to that. One, and I just get this sense from talking to Democrats, Republicans, centrist people, independents. A, let's just get real for a second. I think there's a huge percentage of people who did not take Republicans at their word when they said they were going to overturn Roe v. Wade and actually pass severe abortion restrictions. Let's just be real for a second. You know, there are parts of like the very online left. Crystal's like waded into this rhetoric before where they basically say things like the abortion issue is like a culture war distraction that the Democratic establishment like brings out every few years, but doesn't actually mean anything. Well, now it means something. So I think that now that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, this is no longer a pure hypothetical. Therefore, people are going to, by definition, take it more seriously. Two, and this is the key thing. I do not think this is going to meaningfully change the midterms. What I'm thinking about is what this means for 2024, because as Joe Biden is seeing with defund the police or all these different culture issues, as you know, Sagar, this is rarely, if ever, about the actual laws on the ground. So, for example, Adam Johnson, you know, he's not a fan of either of us, but, you know, I think he's a smart like leftist on Twitter. He had a tweet putting out that, 20 House Democrats just sent a letter to Biden saying, we cannot be the party of defunding the police, like increase like funding this, this or that. Like they're obviously House moderate Democrats who are vulnerable in the 2022 midterms. As Adam points out, Joe Biden has increased funding for the police in his budget. So there was all this rhetoric about defunding the police in 2020. There are all these local and state decisions that Democrats and independents have made that resulted in defunding the police that was very unpopular, especially given the crime wave. But it doesn't actually matter that Joe Biden has increased it because people are focused on that specific story, not the bigger one. The story is Democrats do not care about crime. Democrats do not keep people safe. This, and that. That is the story. That is the narrative that they're responding to. This isn't actually about whether or not Joe Biden increased the federal expenditure in his budget for police. It's about this values-based decision. It's a debate. Actually, and this is the way Nate put it, this is a debate about what kind of society should we live in? Are police good or are they bad? A lot of people think, Democrats think that police are bad. Therefore, it doesn't matter what sheer number of money you put into this. So in the abortion example, it's not going to come down to the exact nature of every single law. I don't think it's going to come down to every single specific election. I think going into 2024, what really matters is the broad meta narrative here. To your point, Sagar, and to your analysis, like once again, left listeners, let's focus on the political and narrative analysis and less whether or not you think these policies are correct. I think it's pretty fair to say that a lot of people in this center, in this Barstool conservative group on the right, even people kind of like the center left, think that there has been a real liberal Democrat, pick whatever phrase you want to use, pushing culture issues to the left. This is the meme that Elon Musk put out where, you know, he says like, I stayed exactly the same. The Democrats ran to the left and the Republicans stayed normal. So everyone just thinks I'm a Republican. That's a basically summation of the meme. It gets so hard to say that when you are going to have Republican states possibly banning IUDs, not just like, not just saying we're going to do a, you know, for example, like the 20-week abortion, like ban limit, it's actually pretty popular nationally. But once you get into the 6 weeks, once you get into the IUDs, once those stories get out and move beyond those states, that narrative is going to matter. And it's going to be very, very, very difficult for folks on the right to basically exploit this opportunity they had, which is basically saying, we, the Republicans, we are the socially moderate party. The Democrats are the ones who are pushing. Yeah, Democrats exactly. are radicals. Elon's meme makes absolutely no sense in a world where Republicans are passing IUD bans, talking about planning Plan B and all of his different parts. That's the key thing. You know, there's always like ridiculous people on Twitter talking about how, oh, like next thing the court's going to like overturn interracial marriage. Like, well, that's just like ridiculous, like Twitter stuff. Like obviously that's not going to happen aside from the fact that, you know, Clarence Thomas has a white wife. The key thing here is that it's actually in the specifics of how this plays out in the narrative that's actually going to go. So Democrats, if they have the opportunity, have the chance to basically turn this into, look, we're not defunding the police. We're not doing these crazy things. It's the Republicans that are crazy. I think there are a lot of people who are not well set up for that type of position. But once again, this is up to Democrats.
Look, nobody knows, right? I mean, that's the real question. Here's the thing. We truly have no idea. I'm just going to bet that things change a lot quicker than people are willing to grapple with. COVID actually did change everything and hit a massive reset on the way that people think about politics and the relationship to government. And in the interim COVID period, we had defund the police, we had critical race theory, and now we have fights over gender ideology. All three of those things trend the Republican way and change the way that a lot of previously center-left people thought about politics and made them open towards supporting a Republican, something that they had never, ever thought about doing before. That is how Glenn Youngkin wins R+2 in a D+5 state. Here's the question. Does that work on a national level whenever the culture war, like you said, is muddled? Here's the deal. Reversal of Roe versus Wade. And actually, this is almost in favor of the pro-lifers who will probably use this argument. Listen, if you're a southern state and you're going below the first trimester, it doesn't matter how many exceptions that you have. The narrative out of it is going to be that you are restricting beyond below the first trimester. Does that make sense, Marshall? Mm-hmm. In terms of, they're going to just be like, you are restricted. It's like, it literally doesn't matter. If you change the Roe status quo, you're going to be perceived as the more extreme party. You can show me as much micro polling as you want. Actually, the American people think a 15-week. Listen, they're not going to give you credit for it, especially if they're on the other side of the debate, because it's about the meta. And for lack of the better term, actually, I might just embrace this. I don't care how stupid it sounds. It's about vibes, man. It's just all about vibes. My new friend, Ruben Rodriguez, shout out to Ruben on Twitter, talked about this, which is that Trump was just purely about jock vibes. Like he was the jock. That's why he was able to get this done. People, you know, everybody's like, oh, thrice divorced, you know, possibly paid for an abortion himself, you know, previously pro-choice. Doesn't matter. Trump was able to convince millions of people in order to vote for him based upon a singular idea that he was just going to stick it to people. And that is a vibe-based decision. Same thing whenever it comes to Roe. You want to be on the right side of the vibes. Once again, do I sound dumb right now? Yeah, probably. But this is how a lot of people think about politics. And, you know, get with the program. Because I think that beginning to understand it this way and not about like individual provisions of a bill. By the way, I'm not saying I don't care about that. I care a lot. But that's not how most people think. So you just need to get into the way that politics works and the way that Trump really revealed just how much of this stuff matters.
I think what I'd add to what you're saying, and we'll get to the next topic, is Roe v. Wade getting overturned sets up what I would articulate as the best case scenario for Biden going into 2024. Now, I would say the Biden argument pretty much comes down to you do not want to give President Trump, and not even President Trump, but just less popular Republicans, the next three Supreme Court justices. Like that is really just going to cross a line for a lot of folks. And it's just like a very, very, very simple. I think people do like the idea. There's a reason why unified government control doesn't last very long. In this country, it's very rare to control, you know, both, you know, the House, Senate, and the presidency for that long. Because I think there's a real argument about balance. Republicans are going to take the House in 2022. Biden and Democrats come in 2024 and basically just say, look, You might not be happy about inflation. You might, like you said, Sagar, I don't think the vibes talk sounds dumb because it's actually, frankly, the
best. It doesn't sound dumb to you, but it just is.
Here's the thing. It's not dumb because the actual key thing here, and a topic I'm increasingly fascinated by, is just like political skill. Mm. A talented politician could pick up that the vibes are slightly off. AKA, a talented politician should have been able to say, okay, it's summer 2020, COVID, things are crazy. I'm going to not pop off on defunding the police.
Yeah, right.
A talented Republican politician, this includes someone like Tom Cotton, could have said, look, there's a lot of people on my side who are really focused on election integrity. Let's be generous and use the phrase they use.
No, don't. Anyway,
I'm saying in December.
Sure.
Because remember, this is what Tom Cotton did. In December, there's a lot of talk about election integrity. There wasn't, you know, January 6th yet. There's all these like, well, the paper ballots and all this like stuff. A lot of Republican politicians leaned all the way into the Coke on top of the table, snorted it, and then beclowned themselves in January. But someone like Tom Cotton was like, yeah, no, I'm just not going to, like, this isn't real and people shouldn't F around with this. Like that is the definition of just picking up a vibe, a direction. And I think there's something, because we're so obsessed with like policy and details and social media followings, we just undercount how important that is. So yeah, I think that the question I'll ask you then, Sagar, and here's how you think about this is, do these culture war issues, do they matter? Because whenever we do these segments, there's a lot of people, and yes, once again, Marshall, don't read the comments, insert the statement, but I think it's actually useful. These sections get a lot of clicks, but there are a lot of people who just clearly feel let down because they're like, you guys are supposed to talk about bringing everyone together. You're supposed to talk about like economics, like labor, all these big topics. And instead you're talking about these big divisive factors, even just basically for clicks. I actually started this show having my goal be that we would never talk about abortion. We would never talk about LGBTQ issues because I wanted to build something different. But one thing I think I was just wrong about, if we go to 2019, it's important to talk about what we were wrong about, is I just think these culture war issues are at the center of everything. And I struggle to think of a single big issue, quote unquote, separate from foreign policy, basically. Actually, not even to a certain degree, where this is free.
Nobody cares about foreign policy. I mean, they do ish. The Ukrainian flags are still up. I can see the data. Nobody cares about foreign policy.
So a quick, when we add to what you said then.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of foreign policy, you have to make decisions. And yeah, okay, that's actually good. So whether or not the Ukrainian flags are up, the Biden administration is going to decide to share intelligence because they have autonomy over it versus national minimum wage, BBB, where you have to do all these different bits, but go on.
Yeah, I think this is an important point to parse. Listen, Trump got 10 million more votes, folks. You square that with what your previous beliefs are. You just have to be honest about how the system works. And if you're not, then you actually can't get past it and build something better. That's what I would like to see. Listen, I want to live in that world. I talk about it all the time. I want to live in a different world. I don't like living in this world. It's boring, honestly. You know, it's like at a certain point, I'm not Christian. You're not going to convince me of your point of view. You know, so it's like, what are we arguing about here? You do you, I'll do me, and we'll vote accordingly. But, you know, on economics and these other things, these things dramatically affect a lot of our lives. I bring as much attention to this stuff as possible. But we have to also be honest about what the main barrier to a lot of it is. A lot of the leftists don't want to hear this stuff. They're like, oh, you know, I was talking with Crystal actually about Medicare for All. And I was like, Medicare for All is not going to happen. I can't remember exactly what I said. And I was like, and I'll tell you exactly why. Trans surgery. And she was like, well, I'd like to think that if everybody got their stuff covered, that they wouldn't care. And I'm like, no, they actually won't. Like, it literally won't happen because of that one issue. You can hate that if you would like, or you can grapple with reality. And look, Sagar, I know these things
go ahead. Because this is something I love when you make this point, because it's very, people don't think, explain what you mean by trans surgery coverage, specifically being an impediment. By talking about it.
I mean, I remember seeing this during the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I don't exactly know what happened, but that Bernie was somehow painted as a transphobe because he likes Joe Rogan, whatever. So his secretary at the time put out a thing being like, Bernie's the most pro-trans candidate because Medicare for All will cover transistent surgeries. And I was like, oh, well, then you can kiss the entire thing goodbye. Look, this is a divisive social policy, no matter where that you fall on the spectrum. And the idea of government dollars going towards that. Also, by the way, we haven't even talked about abortion. Does Medicare for All cover abortion? Because liberals say that abortion is healthcare. Well, guess what? In an entire group of people who would possibly support, I don't know, like diabetes meds for everybody and insulin is not going to support that. And especially after 2 years of the government screwing up, which what in retrospect is going to look like a pretty easy pandemic in relation to everything else. So we have zero trust in our medical establishment. We know that they're impacted by social policy, a la actually you can't get the virus if you go to a Black Lives Matter protest, but a mask mandate protest is completely ridiculous. Well, you got no trust in their ability in order to fairly apply the rules, and you are trying to use government dollars on an issue where a huge portion of the public doesn't agree with you. And actually, and this gets to my Barstool point, a lot of people, I would say the majority of people, will say, hey, listen, you want to use your money and do whatever you want? Go for it. Now, look, I can already hear the people screaming. Yes, kids are a different conversation. I'm talking about adults, 18 plus. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, Marshall, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that 75% of people are going to be mostly okay by saying, if you want to pay for your own stuff and do whatever you want to your own body, be my guest, but I don't want to pay for it. I don't want to be involved in that. And that's not necessarily something I want to sanction and also give public health bureaucrats a jurisdiction over this, which could then possibly be used on my family member. You may think I sound crazy, but this is actually real decisions that Europeans have to make. There was a reason that, remember all those famous cases about kids being allowed to die in Europe and Americans get very jazzed about this? This happened in 2000.
I'm from Oregon. Oregon had death dignity laws. So like this was a big thing.
There you go. Well, see, that's a little different though. Those people have terminal cancer. I'm talking about like in Europe.
There was
like a kid, I think it was Italy. And the medical board was like, that's it. You know, we're ceasing care. And his parents were like, but we want to fly him to London to go get healthcare. They're like, no, you can't. And so there's this whole debate, you know, people sent money and like there was a big argument here. I remember at the time of people being like, this is why we can't have universal health care. You can poo-poo this one example if you want, but this shit matters. And this is how people vote. So this is what I mean about you have to grapple with these issues. I remember another one. Bernie was like, Medicare for All will apply to illegal immigrants. I was like, yeah, okay, good luck. Yeah, good luck getting that passed. And it's like, this is also my critique of the left, where I'm like, what you're really telling me is that healthcare for trans surgery, abortion, and illegal immigration is more important to you than diabetes medicine for the entire US population, which you probably could get 70-something% for. But yeah.
No,
this is uncomfortable to talk about, but this is just unambiguously true. Like, this is how politics works now. Deal with it.
I'll follow up on this because you're actually reminding me of our debate with Kyle and Crystal during our Breaking Points crossover last month. And you're really just getting it. And once again, like we're going to do more of those. And it's difficult to debate these topics, right? So I'm going to cheat and say the point now that they're off stage. But look, they kept on. So like for listeners who didn't watch that episode, I really recommend you take a look at it on the Breaking Points channel. Also high production value. So it's fun to look at that. It's so much more fun to do this than over Zoom or Riverside. But the quick thing here is they were talking about how, you know, Medicare for All has like 68%, 70%. Approval. The fact that it has not happened is like a sign of just like how corrupt and how like broken everything is. And I was just sort of like, yeah, it's what you're saying here exactly. Which is if you look and say abstractly to people.
Yeah. Healthcare. Everyone's healthcare like, yeah, sure.
For everyone. And let's not even be cheap and say like, they don't know how much it costs.
Yeah,
no,
sure.
Like let's be very generous and tell people, because look, right. Like I think, you know, something that, you know, leftists will point out is that like, look, the American private healthcare system, like, is one of the most expensive in the world.
Yeah,
so we're already spending more.
Right.
And privately, than many Europeans do. Like, obviously our economy is bigger, but proportionally. So let's put aside the cost. If you tell people, hey, like, we're going to shift these costs here, that gets 70%. Totally true. But I think what leftists have consistently missed, and then we'll get into, I want to get into Nina Turner's race in a second in Ohio, attached to JD. But what they miss is that a key political skill, and this is why you talking about vibes matters so much, is, okay, so you gave me this number. What does that number actually mean? Does that 70% mean that everyone wants this thing, or a crazy majority of people want this thing? Or does it mean the story is much more complicated if we still don't have that policy? Mm. And to your point, Sagar, the second that you got into details, once again, this is the nature of our system. The second that Marjorie Taylor Greene finds out that there's a trans abortion section, think, okay, perfect example. Think of Obamacare in 2010.
Yeah,
something that hypothetically, right. Exactly, something that hypothetically pulled really well going into the 2009 administration of President Obama for his first term, death panels.
Oh, and by the way, death panels wasn't even true.
Yeah,
this bullshit. One's actually true.
Like Sarah, for people who missed this, yeah. Like Sarah Palin seizes upon this like very obscure, because this is how this works in policy terms. There'll be like some obscure like section that it basically was about like end of life care advising, stuff like that. She then Fox Newsifies it, dials it up to 11 and says, this thing is going to establish death panels that will determine whether or not old people live or die. Like, yes or no, like very Orwellian 1984, mixing my books here, but type situations. Obviously, like everyone, it's been 11 years, Obamacare passed, and it's been upheld by the court. The death panels aren't real. But even that fueled years. And by the way, this Obamacare only wasn't overturned or repealed because John McCain in his last year of life said no to it. And I think so much of the roots really exist there. So like, it's just, you just have to understand the political system here. Cause like my key thing, and once again, people hated this, Kyle and Crystal pushed back on this, but I actually believe that if there was 70% support for Medicare for all at the level they are alleging, and you had worked through these different bits, I think the conversation would be much more forward facing. Yes, there's corruption. Yeah. Yes, there's spending, but all, yeah, so fair. I don't want to overstate it, but my point is simply look at that 70% number. If you see that it hasn't passed in this case, and inconveniently so, it's actually not that like big pharma is like dropping like dollar bills in everyone's pockets. It's actually that it's actually that there are very super complicated first order culture war questions that are going to blow it up.
Well, I would submit, if you really care about defeating big pharma, that then by grasping at fringe social issues and insisting on them, then you're the person who's actually standing in the way. You know, and that's a complicated way of framing that, but I think it's absolutely true.
Politics. And it's a coalition. Like, yeah, you're describing politics. Like that's what you're saying here.
Like I said, listen, if you had a bill purely in order to cover insulin costs, I would be willing to bet that you could probably get that done.
Let's play that. So do you mean
talk about diabetics?
Yeah. So let's assume the time period. Yeah. So let's say first six months of Biden administration. That's our time frame.
A standalone bill in order to lower the cost of insulin to how much it costs in Canada. You get that done. Now look, and if you don't, it's actually a lot easier to attack Kyrsten Sinema, who is the main opponent right now on pharma. So she actually is like very opposed to negotiating prescription drug pricing, which again, I think is a bullshit policy. So if you put that standalone, it'd be way easier in order to attack her. But the meta narrative, the vibe in Arizona, where she's a very high approval rating, by the way, is that she's standing up to Joe Biden. It's not about prescription drugs.
Who is not popular in Arizona.
They bundle it and all of this bullshit. And so they don't actually, this is, again, I'm a huge proponent of the stuff we used to do in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. We should just have standalone votes on different stuff. This is part of, gets to a whole conversation about how the Senate is broken, but the bundling process is terrible for actual politics and makes it, and look, they do this shit intentionally, and this is a systemic thing. The Republicans do it. Fucking Democrats do it. Like the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was, you know, they did a corporate tax decrease combined with a modest middle class decrease for a freaking reason, right? And they do it through reconciliation, closure, et cetera. Look, this is a broken record, but it really does matter. But I'm telling you, though, that is the level of fight of which you now have to start getting involved in. And we almost had that. We came very close, Marshall. 2020, Mitch McConnell refused to put a standalone $2,000 stimulus check bill on the floor. Refused to do it. He was going to pair it with, I forget exactly, I'm forgetting a lot of this stuff. But in December of 2020, he refused to put a standalone $2,000 check piece of legislation on the floor for exactly this reason. Oh, it was a liability waiver. It was like corporate liability or some bullshit like that. And obviously, it wouldn't pass. But there's a reason that they don't do this stuff, guys. And that is as close to a real direct democracy push in the Senate that we almost got on something that 70, 80% of the American people support. No matter how you feel about the policy now, I'm talking about try and put yourself back in at that time. I thought it was a very revealing moment that they're like, now we're just not going to vote on it. There's a reason.
I think the last note I'll put on this topic, and this is really what I want folks to understand in terms of like what we are doing on the realignment right now, which is, look, you can do and think whatever you want about these topics. Like you could totally disagree with Sagar on trans coverage. You could disagree on CRT.
I don't care.
You could say that I'm a vanilla populist. I mean, I'm not even a fucking populist. I'm referencing, there's been some, the quick thing inside baseball, like people in DC like are, when we have these conversations, it's sort of difficult for people to see where we stand. And actually, like, I'm happy with that because all I'm basically trying to do here, and this is leading to my actual point, is that I want folks just to think more critically about these things because my key takeaway in all of these situations is I have no perception at all that anyone effectively knows what they're doing right now. At like a deep strategic level. I think that a lot of people's mental models for how they think about like the country and the problems facing us are just totally, totally, totally screwed up. And I think we should be doing our best to actually make that better for people as much as possible. So I want to get into our next topic. We've got two or three more here and talk about the Ukraine war. To your point, the media, and I'm not a huge fan of like the current thing meme on Twitter, just because, and look, we don't talk enough about this. The world is crazy right now. Like actually, do you know what I mean? Like for a lot of folks, you know, people have said, oh, like all these people who cared so much about Ukraine, you know, they put away the flags, like they're not tweeting about it. Like, look, let's get real for a second. I did a 30-day series on this for a reason. The reason why people were so engaged in the Ukraine question was for 30 days, for that first month, there was a real question of, wow, is Putin going to conquer this country? And are the Baltics and Poland going to be next? One of the most, like, to your point, Sagar, regardless how you feel about this question, that is one of the most important geopolitical questions of the age. Because Ukraine survived that first month, this is now transformed from this great geopolitical hinge point to this, okay, this now looks much more like the war looked for the past 8 years beforehand, which is lots of great death, war. Lots of dying, but it's on the side. The question isn't like, Nancy Pelosi went to Kyiv, right? Like that means something in terms of like the safety of the actual region. You know, the Secretary of State went, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So the conflict has just transformed. I am not expecting people, once this is no longer an existential question for Ukraine, once again, if you're Zelensky, you say that, you know, the Donbass and Crimea are existential. I would say from a geopolitical national perspective, the world will move on if Ukraine never gets Crimea back, and if eastern parts of the country don't reassess themselves. But I just want to get like your let's just start and just get your overall take, because this episode is coming out on Tuesday the 10th, and yesterday, you know, recording this as if I'm doing this today on Tuesday, but you know, yesterday was May 9th, which is a incredibly important day in Russian history. Like, let's just take a step back, like explain why this date for folks is like being bandied about so much.
Yeah, May 9 was a time when Putin really wanted to hail a big strategic victory in Russia. It's known as the victory over the Nazis. It doesn't 100% translate to English, but basically they call it the Great Patriotic War. It's a very celebratory day in Russian history. People need to remember 23 million Russians died on the Eastern Front in World War II, and 7 out of every 10 Nazi casualties was suffered also on the Eastern Front. Far more of the consequential battles happened in the East relative to how much we like to lionize ourselves in the West.
Can I say something real quick? Because it's very important. I really hate when people do this whole bit of like, in America, we don't teach enough about like how actually like it was the Soviets who won the war. And that's there's something true about that. But what I think people
that's
usually
kind of true.
What, it's kind of true, but here's what people.
You're talking about the tankies who make that point.
Yeah, yeah, tanky. Yeah.
Yeah.
But here's something that the Russians do not talk about. For the first 2 years of the war, Hitler and Stalin were allies. Oh, so yeah. let's be very clear.
Also, U.S. materiel was the main reason that they were even able to survive on the Eastern Front. So
yeah, more than I just mean, because this is just important history, because like we're revisiting World War II and all these basic realities. Yes, like the Soviet soldier did the vast majority of the fighting and dying in the worst conditions in that part of the war, right? Like no... You know, at individual level, just deep heroism, which like needs to be acknowledged. But like when we focus on the Soviet state, let's remember it wasn't just Hitler who invaded Poland in 1939. It was the Soviet Union who invaded the Baltics, who were independent republics. They invaded Poland themselves. They signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, non-aggression pact. Actually, it's actually crazy. I'm doing Andrew Roberts, who a biographer we like. He did a good World War II history book. It's called The Storm of War. German U-boats were docking in Soviet ports going into 1941. So like the key overall point here is like, I just get annoyed when people use the deep sacrifices of like the Russian individual soldier to basically act as if like the Soviet state was not, frankly, they did it to themselves.
Well,
they made
also,
some big choices.
They really, I mean, look, people should go and read how they treated their own men. They basically ordered them to die, and they set up a system where if you didn't put yourself on the line of fire, I mean, look, Stalin threw his own son's wife into the gulag because his son got captured. That was the policy. So there's a reason that they all fought to the death, because they knew that if they got captured, that their little kids and their wives would be sent to the gulag and that their families would suffer. So
one quick thing, Sagar, love the history trivia. So I need to add one story, because it's like it's crazy. It shows the stakes here. Stalin's son is captured. Russians were not supposed to be captured. Yeah. Sorry, Soviets were supposed to be captured.
Members of the party were not supposed to be captured. Not just members of the party, because
not everyone was a Communist Party member. Right. Soviet armies were not supposed to be captured. They were supposed to stand and die, not retreat, especially in the first bits of the war. So Stalin's son is captured, breaks every single rule. He dies in 1943 in a German prisoner of war camp. Two reasons for this death. One, he was trying to escape, which is what the Nazis said. The more likely thing, the historians agree, is that he was committing suicide by escape, because if he'd been repatriated. Like, and this is why World War II, this is just why like the Eastern Front, this is what's crazy. Like when Soviet troops were freed, quote unquote, a lot of them went into the gulags and never came back out after the war.
Many of them were killed. Yeah, they were killed because
you're right. So like going to a gulag in Siberia equals a death sentence. But sorry, just get back to the picture. But I just think like this is the Russian history that like we just don't know that much about.
This is, I got a Stalin book behind me. It's an excellent book by Stephen
Kotkin.
Stephen Kotkin.
Oh, he has a two volume. I guess it's going to be three volumes, but he's got like
three.
A two.
This is the first volume. This is an excellent book. I highly recommend people read it. Also, just final plug, guys, go listen to Ghosts of the Ostfront, Dan Carlin. It was actually the original, and I didn't know this, the first long series that he made. It was back in like 2000.
I listened to it back in high school. I remember this.
Maybe 2009, honestly. Yeah. And it's incredible. I re-listened to it every once in a while. That's where I learned a lot of this stuff. Man, I mean, some of this. Anyway, they don't tell you that part of the history. In the great patriotic war discourse in Russia. But anyway, it matters a lot because they celebrate a lot of these people, and they really wanted to have a big victory, and that didn't actually work out for Putin. Part of the reason why people expected kind of a major strategic offensive currently, because they want to be able to hail something at home, because they want to be like, hey, what year is it? 2022? So how far are we away from 1945? Whatever. It doesn't matter.
Guys, we podcast in YouTube for a reason. We're not here to do the math.
It's not an 80th anniversary or whatever, but it's still consequential. And so what they're looking for is
one quick thing, Sagar.
Yeah, go ahead.
They call the Ukrainians Nazis. So like,
yeah,
so,
that's
so,
right.
so, so
this like, is part like, of why it matters.
And by the way, like they don't just mean like Nazi in the sense that like we will throw around the term Nazi in American discourse, but like the actual claim, once again, I know there are tankies who listen who aren't going to be happy. The actual claim is this is a Nazi infested regime. So if the Great Patriotic War is this fight to the literal death with Nazism in the 40s, this metaphor deeply matters on May 9th for the Russians.
Yeah, matters a lot. The Nazi stuff matters a lot. By the way, most Russians agree. And look, obviously it's complicated. Like, yes, there is an Azov battalion. Yes, it is neo-Nazi. Yes, that party has a constituency in the party. Is it the majority of the ruling coalition in Ukraine? No. Is it the majority of the Ukrainian military? No. Is it a concern of the United States? Yes. Are the Russians exaggerating that the Ukraine is full of Nazis? Obviously. Okay. Nuance out of the way, because apparently that's fucking hard for people to understand. The current state of the war is one of almost complete stalemate, of which will burn now for 8 years. Russia has suffered immensely, major reputational damage on the world stage. Now, the real question comes down to what will the Russians do? What will the Russians do? Will they respond with an offensive on May 9th in order to commemorate the occasion? Will this be kind of the new status quo, which is actually on the ground? Of that, we simply have no idea. So that's kind of where we're at right now in terms of war discourse.
Yeah, no, I think the real question right now is what Putin does next, because—
Well, did you see these reports that he has cancer? No. I don't know if this is true. I don't even know if I should be saying this, but—
okay, no, please. So yeah,
if I'm going to say
that and be like, we're going to put them to the side.
Okay, so again, this is out there. There are rumors right now that Putin has cancer, and that he is planning to take a temporary leave of command due to ill health. And experts are announcing a big announcement on Russia's May 9th victory day. So we don't know what that is. I'm really curious what happened. Because there's a lot of speculation in the Indian press and elsewhere that he's about to undergo some cancer surgery. And I think that matters because, you know, we don't know what the hell is going to happen.
Look, he does not look healthy. That's all you can say. And we didn't need to, like, you know, the whole he's like overroided on like testosterone takes were a bit much and not unhelpful. But I think it's like pretty clear that something, whether it's the—
Something
you know,
was
crazy
going on
table,
with his health, right?
Something's going
like
on.
Like he was going, you know, listen, what kind of freak is that afraid of COVID? That's weird, right? That's personally, I think that's immunocompromised behavior. Yeah. Nobody else behaves that way. Nobody. So
yes.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, so the thing that's like, you and I have like had some disagreements on Ukraine. I think that, you know, we just did a lot of like dumping on Biden. We'll get to the intelligence leaks in a second, but I think, look, overall, Putin's in a really tough bit here because largely speaking, the Biden policy has effectively worked. From the start, say no NATO boots on the ground, no no-fly zone, operating. Yes, obviously there is like we're providing them intelligence, we're sending them weapons, but like frankly, like that's within the expected rules of war. You know, like this is the Soviets supported the North Koreans in the 1950s. They supported the North Vietnamese. We supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. The Iranians supported the insurgency in Iraq in the 2000s. Like this is just what happens. And as long as the rule in war, you know, I know we just did a episode saying that there are no rules in war, but the rule, which has been followed by both sides at this point, in this conflict has been as long as the red line is really like a opposing, the red line is US troops physically going in with javelins and destroying Russian tanks. If it is US javelins in Ukrainian hands, that sucks. That's a really overly colloquial way to put it. That's how this rule works, right? Like obviously the US didn't want Soviets training Vietnamese pilots in Vietnam in the 1960s, but there was literally nothing you could do about it. And it's just a factor. It's like the weather. It's like there's going to be bad weather and it's something you deal with.
So, I think, can I clarify something? I've never been against arms or whatever to Ukraine. What I've been is about hysteria and possible overreach and just the want in order to consider consequences.
Yeah.
I'm fine with sending weapons to Ukraine. I've openly said that, by the way. What I'm concerned about is, dude, we just keep re-up. I mean, we sent 1/5 the amount of javelins that we have in American stock over to Ukraine. We've sent Ukraine more military aid than we've supplied any other country except for Israel, Egypt, and there's one other one in our history since 1946. You can maybe you're justify that. Maybe. I think we should have some consideration because I'm legitimately concerned about the Libyan civil war, Syrian civil war, spillover effect, having watched all of this happen in the Middle East. And I don't think a lot of people are being honest about that. I know you are, but let's be honest. Like, listen, we're now going into a hot grade insurgency. We got Chechens coming in, Dagestani's coming in, Syrians are flying in. This is when the shit really heats up. This has only been on for 2 months. Think back to 2013 with Syria. The amount of weapons that have flooded into Ukraine has got serious spillover consequences 5 to 6 years from now. Nobody ever wants to talk about or consider.
So here's the key difference. And I'm so happy you brought up this example, because it's really, once again, like when I call myself a moderate interventionist to the piss off of certain listeners, this really speaks to what we're getting at, which is you're totally right to bring up Syria and Libya as just like the worst case scenario intervention situation.
It just happened.
But to be clear, neither country had a functioning state. So there's a standard here, right? So like, once again, to your point where we're totally simpatico, moderate rebels is the term that we basically, I just said moderate interventionist, but the term moderate rebels, especially in a Islamic Middle Eastern context, basically just should be jettisoned, because the region is just so complicated that it really just like it. It does not describe the situation in a way that it really helped people. Because once again, like the whole point of this podcast is like, what language are we using to describe situations? The word moderate means something to people in American and probably a Western domestic political context
in the West
that does not translate properly to the nuances of, once again, like post Arab Spring conflicts. So my point here is, look, if this, let's say, for example, Sagar, the Ukrainian state had collapsed, and in the let's say Putin's plan had worked, and you know, I'm always praising U.S. intelligence on this show. U.S. intel said that Kyiv was going to fall in 4 days, and Zelensky needed to get out. So like aside in this conflict, we've gotten plenty of big things wrong. But if the Ukrainian state had just totally collapsed and it turns into this weird hodgepodge, I would be very wary of pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars into a collapsed, failed state. Because once again,
could still happen. I mean, the weapons are there now.
Yeah, but here's the thing: it's not going to happen. I'm just gonna less cautious. Like you are very brave. I mean this really seriously. Like people dunk on you and Krista when you guys get things wrong, but like it's actually like important that like people have opinions, so we're not just basically like,
that's my other thing
about.
Can I address this for a second?
Would
you rather me be mealy mouthed? Why don't I just tell you what I think? I get shit wrong all the time. I love to admit it. It's also funny to me that the MSNBC crowd, who never admit that they're wrong, will always use that as like, oh, you're the guys who said that they're gonna invade Ukraine. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, you want to play this game, or like, can we just assume that? Like, that's my thing about the Iraq stuff. I'd be like, look, if you're in good faith, if you're wrong, I think you're a sack of shit. But as long as you admit to it, we're generally okay. What I hate is when people just won't admit it. It's like people need to admit when they're wrong. And also, isn't life more fun when you're like, listen, I think this is what's going to happen. That's all. Part of the reason I read so much history is to try and imbibe the thinking of people who are in the context of the times and make the decisions that they are going to make, and then see how it plays out. Whenever they're wrong, they have to readjust their thinking, how things exactly come to be. I try to take the stigma out of it and be like, okay, what was the guy thinking? I never thought I would be sympathetic to Neville Chamberlain. I'm probably the biggest Chamberlain stan that there is now, because I read a whole book and I was like, oh, wow, I get it. I completely understand how it happened. And when people lose that capacity, whenever people do stuff get wrong, they're losing a lot of very useful thinking. Anyway, go ahead.
No, the key thing that you're getting at, though, because I'm listening to what you're saying, and I think the one thing in our last like 7 minutes here, the one thing I would just add to what you're saying, though, is that I don't want people just to pop off. So it's like it's just like important here. So the key thing is, look at those books behind you. Look at our joint Audible account. Like, you aren't just like waking up being like, I'm going to just like futz out this take. Mm-hmm. I think people, for example, homie who tweeted that the court is going to overturn interracial marriage next, I think you should not have popped that off.
Yeah.
Just like, there's a difference.
It's not well considered. My point. It's not a well considered point. Most of what I tell you guys is very well considered. You can ask Marshall. I workshop a lot. I'll be like, yeah, you know, here's what I'm thinking. And like, here's what, you know, like how I come to this decision. And, you know, why don't we go ahead and talk about Intel? This is a good example.
Yeah.
My mind immediately jumped to, well, there was a time in, you know, recent discourse where America thought that Russia was paying bounties on our soldiers to Taliban soldiers. And there was an immediate response by the United States, Ben Sasse, and several other Democrats at the time who said that we should start killing Russians in response. So whenever our idiot officials are open, that's my editorial, are openly bragging about helping assassinate Russian generals and sinking Russian warships, how about you keep your fucking mouth shut? Or you could possibly expect that Moscow will respond in kind. But I'm not denigrating the action. Like you said, I mean, listen, you think the Russians didn't know this was going on? You know, it's more about why can these people not keep their fucking mouth shut? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is you're jazzed up, I think, for a reason, because this is actually, it's good when we find the points of agreement in Ukraine. So here's the context. So the New York Times had a story out 2 days ago that basically said, in its headline especially, U.S. intel is helping kill Russian generals in Ukraine. So basically, our assumption is that 12 Russian generals have died in Ukraine. Like, that's nuts, right? Like, that is World War II levels of like brigadier and above. I mean, that's not quite the Russian equivalent, but you know, that's insane. That is not something
that
happens. And this isn't like, so for example, we had like we've had American like general officers die, especially in the war on terror, like in a suicide bombing. Like, this is
maybe two or three.
This is honestly, like battlefield, right?
Also in Vietnam, we did not lose a lot of generals.
The key thing here is that you are really looking at a situation where you have battlefield deaths, and this happens like strategically and tactically because I love this kind of like nerdy military stuff, which basically in the US, like we at a doctrinal level place a lot of emphasis on non-commissioned officers. So that's like corporals and above having a lot of like input and control. There's a lot of like responsibility that's pushed down the stack in terms of command. In the Russian situation, like their army is like very, very, very top down. So the reason why where a lot of these generals are dying, especially in the earliest parts of the battle, is there is a situation where it's like, okay, we were going to cross this bridge, but the Ukrainians blew the bridge. What do we do? Okay, I can't authorize that. I'm just like a sergeant, or I'm just like a captain or a major. And then you have to have the general come from the command post. Literally, one of the generals that died was a civil engineering general who was on the spot directing a bridge crossing process, and he's killed by a sniper rifle, I'm pretty sure. That's insane. So to the point of the actual story, so the story is that U.S. intel is doing this. So there's two parts to attack here. So one, this story was slightly mischaracterized, and the person who wrote the headline, in order to get some clicks, screwed up. This is where I'll defend the Biden administration, then you attack the Biden administration. Right, we'll do the 1-2 thing. Mm-hmm. U.S. intel, and there's pretty consensus on this. The way this works is that the U.S. is providing intelligence support to Ukrainian forces. That will include everything from this battalion is moving this way. For example, with the sinking of the Russian flagship, they asked for verification that it was the flagship they thought it was, and we're like, yes. That is actually technically different than the US waking up and saying, our number one objective is this general is here, this general is there, that general is there. That is why the headline was actually unhelpfully. And by the way, this is what you're going to say. Officials should not be commenting on inaccurately framed stories. So the point is, when the U.S., when the Ukrainians say, okay, like, is this battalion group moving to X location? And we verify it. If there's a general there, a general is going to get killed. But once again, that is different than us waking up and saying the number one duty of American intelligence right now is to kill Russian generals. That's not what's happening. Sagar, where's the real screw up here then?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even a screw up. I'm like, what are you people smoking? They're bragging about this.
The officials.
Officials. The intelligence officials are bragging about this to the New York Times. And I know a coordinated leak when I see it. The Times story breaks, and then CNN, NBC News, and all these other people. I'm like, oh, the same three people are not keeping their mouth shut. I would not be surprised if they called them all into a little room, into a meeting room over at the CIA, which I won't say whether I've been to or not, which is let's just say well-stocked and equipped with officials who are pushing certain lines of propaganda. Well, guess what? I'm 90% sure that that's what happened. And I know that that did not happen without sign off from the White House. So my message to the White House is shut the fuck up, because now you are putting us in a situation where, look, I mean, I don't wish this, but Moscow, within, you know, the rules of the game, which we also subscribe to during the Russian bounties one, would be within the general rights in order to try. And let's just say if some of our troops start blowing up in Iraq, or, you know, in a convoy or somewhere in the Middle East, people forget this, we still have troops in Syria. If one of those guys steps on an IED and the Russians are involved, I'm not going to be that surprised about it. And I'm not going to be happy about it, but that could lead to escalation. And I don't even think that the Russians don't know that this is happening.
They obviously know.
Why are we bragging about it openly in the press? I think the Biden administration wants to seem strong, and they're thinking maybe this is like a midterm play, but this is a level of hubris which is insane. And it just shows you that they are not afraid of escalation. And what I want are people who, listen, you criticize me for being too much of a dove, maybe. You know, if people want to say that, they could say it. I think it's fair. But the consideration that I'm asking people to make is the then what question, and then really think about what the consequences of that look like. Because, listen, we got thousands of troops out there in that ground. You know, the Russians, you put it against them that some of these guys start dying of mysterious circumstances. I don't want to see that. And then we have to respond. And then you're in a doom loop. Like, you don't know how far exactly that's going to go. It may not go kinetic immediately, but it's all about the chain. Think back to the history of war. Okay, so it's May 6th. When did Russia invade?
February 28th? 24th to 26th.
This war is only 2 months old, okay? What happened in the first 2 months of World War II? People don't even know. That's the point that I'm trying to make. We're still very, very early in this conflict. And bragging and, you know, having the hubris to think this is end and that this could be the end state is a huge mistake. I don't know what they're doing. I think they're not too big for their britches. Or these are intel officials speaking out of turn, which, by the way, if that's the case, fire their ass.
I think yeah. So I'll put the last word on this. The Biden administration super pushed back on the reporting. I think there is a degree.
May have authorized it, and then they would have come out and saw the reaction. Maybe, I'll tell you what, they may have authorized the version of the story you told. And then the New York Times writes it. One way, they're like, oh shit. They're like, we don't want anything to do with
that. Yeah. So that's all I mean. Here's what I think happened here. Like you said, Sagar, you've gotten good mileage out of this and justified mileage. If you're in the US intel community, past 20 years, it's not been a good time. And once again, I know this is a complicated topic. There's perceived responsibility for failing to predict and interdict 9/11. Right, that's why we create the DHS. That's why we reorganize everything. Yeah, those bits.
It should be.
So that happens. Then the Iraq War happens. You get Osama bin Laden. That's great. But then, like, the Arab Spring happens. You don't really predict that. Things go crazy. All these different bits. So being a member of this community has not been, let's just say, a covered with glory experience. Also, by the way, like, the American public is totally ambiguous. Towards even the war on terror. So even the successes that you get, just ambiguity.
Right. They're like, we killed Zarqawi. It's like, why did it take so fucking long?
Yeah. Well, and not even just that part, but also, like, so once again, killing Osama bin Laden, huge win for the intel community. Here's the thing, the war in Afghanistan goes on for another 10 years.
That's right.
No one thinks about that story. So coming into the Ukraine war, the intel community pursued the proper and innovative strategy of just leaking out as much intel as possible, because there was a strategic objective there, right? It was, we want to leave there zero ambiguity that Putin is going to do this, 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 and that. We have sources. We think he's going to invade. We don't want him. He's going to maybe use a false flag attack. We're going to leak that way. That was a purposeful leaking process. So that happens. And everyone is just like, me included, is like, yes, intel community, like, you guys have done it. This is brilliant. This is awesome. The war goes on. Russia doesn't capture Ukraine in the first month. They pull back from Kyiv. It's now going into the third month. If you're a member of Intel community, you are just like very high. Like, I think you're high on yourself right now. Mm-hmm. And not that you haven't done incredibly important and impressive things like helping sink the Russian flagship, coordinating these efforts, also without like getting like a, like, and this is always, by the way, like why the whole like get NATO on the ground people were wrong. Like, it was actually possible to defend Kyiv just by providing support. So like, it's working. But now there's just this, it's like you're saying, sorry, it's this real, there's a need to rub everyone's face in it when it's just like, no, just like, this is like the whole like, dude, speak softly, carry a big stick.
Let's yeah, do the, let's it's kind of like, Roosevelt remember at quote. The end of Argo when they
I
were like-
I've actually never seen Argo. It's on it's Netflix. I need to
it's
watch it.
It's on Netflix.
It.
You should watch it. Overrated and Zero Dark Thirty still should have won Best Picture, but whatever. At the end of Argo, spoiler alert, they get out.
No.
At the end, they were like, they are drinking champagne and they're like, nobody's ever going to know that we were involved. And they didn't for like 30 years. There was a geopolitical strategic.
This is the deal. That's the exactly. Yeah. That's exactly.
You signed up for it. I don't know what to tell you.
But yeah, so we're at time here. Went a little over an hour, but this is really great, Sagar. Thanks for doing this, and we'll keep these episodes out.
See you guys.
Reminder: Substack subscription, Bookshop book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.